To me, what's interesting about the case is actually nothing to do with the fundraising thing at the end, but it's really about, someone had the question here about, okay, let's say we stipulate that, yes, we're going to get customer feedback, but we're not going to do a giant focus group. Then what? So we get these piles of feedback. What's the process by which we make sense of all that information? How do we collect the feedback, and how do we actually make decisions based on all that noise? Because one of the things that's not really in the case, someone said there didn't have any customer feedback. Someone had that comment, I seem to recall, yeah. That's what it says in the case, right? That's actually not true. There was obsessed with customer feedback. There did more focus groups than any other company I've ever been involved in. There was focus groups going on all the time to test usability, to test who was going to pay for it, to figure out who the target customer was. I can't tell you the level of detail of the customer archetypes there had at launch. The problem was that that was all fictionalized. It was based on what the company wanted to hear, because focus groups, they weren't actually conducted focus groups in their job. What's wrong with focus groups? Yeah, engineering principle is garbage in, garbage out. So most focus groups, it's very easy to conduct a focus group and get the answer you wanted coming in. So you never kind of, it's rare to have someone conduct a focus group. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen this. A marketing person says, we had this idea for product. We conducted a focus group. You know what? It's a bad idea. Cancel it. Let's try something different. I don't think I've ever seen that in my career. So I wanted to talk today about the process by which we built a company designed to answer those questions. And so I brought some slides to do that. But I want to see, are there other questions about the case? People dying to know about InView?
So I have a question about Dan.com. I mean, did it fail because there were too many yes men in the company who didn't question what the founders were doing or what exactly was the problem? Because, you know, if there are people who object to a number of things that the founders do, let's say, then there'd be less a chance for the startup failing, right? So what was it really? Was it the founder's ego or...
we have a plethora of choices there. We have too many reasons it failed. And I think the real question is, what was the root cause of the failure? There's lots of, but once you make kind of a basic fundamental strategic mistakes, all kinds of other failures cascade out. But I think, to me, it was a lack of a commitment to the truth. That is, the company was not dedicated to finding out what the business opportunity really was. We were dedicated to building out this vision and making it work. So we weren't actually that interested as a company in whether it's a good idea or not. We knew it was a good idea, and you know, anybody that said otherwise was crazy. So we built a kind of reality distortion field around our idea that allows us to ignore the truth. But if you're paying attention, you'll say, but isn't that an attribute of great entrepreneurs, that they're visionaries who can make people believe that something that doesn't exist actually is a great idea? And that's also true. So we'll talk a little bit about how to tell the difference between vision and delusion, and kind of how do you build a process to do that on a systematic basis? Yeah.
The question is, like, I saw these screenshots of IMDb, and it did look very much oriented toward like a younger audience. So I'm wondering, why was there this confusion about the business users?
Thank you for asking that, because one of the things that drove us crazy all throughout InView's history, and InView's now almost 5 years old, still drives the company crazy, is that no matter what the company does, it attracts these massive numbers of teenagers. And you gotta imagine that in the early days, we would try to use our own products, communication product, to talk to our target customers. We're gonna be these, you know, middle-aged housewives who are gonna buy the product. And we would literally, we had this feature that would let you chat with someone at random. So we just push the button and boom, chatting with someone selected at random who also wants to chat at that moment. And we kept getting teenager after teenager who we couldn't even communicate with. They used a special dialect of, you know, IM speak that we couldn't even understand. And then we kept, you know, bailing out of them, like, no. Get out of the way, we're trying to talk to our target customer, right? So, and we would always, at board meeting after board meeting, we would have this discussion about how the site looks like it's targeted at teenagers, and that's why the teenagers are showing up. So I can't tell, we've probably conducted 20 or 30 full site redesigns to make the product look like it should appeal to a different demographic. And I can conclusively tell you, we have all the empirical evidence that you need, that it actually has nothing to do with it. We have not been able to do any design for that product to make it seem like it appeals an older demographic, because it turns out the whole concept, teenagers and adults agree, this is a product for young people. Like, you can package it up however you want. It's something about that concept is very sticky as that young demographic. But it's important to see just how incredibly deluded we were about what this thing was all about. We really didn't know what we didn't know. Even though they had one of our founders, and even though they were going to copy, I mean, we published the spec for our product publicly. We didn't have any secrets. We were very public with our customers about what we were trying to do and why. So they knew, they had one of our founders, they had all the data we published publicly and anything they wanted. Still took them like a year and a half to bring Lively to market, and it still was terrible. So it was one of those interesting cases where you always get asked as a startup, well, what's to prevent a giant company from just copying you and doing it? And you have to be prepared with that question. But we actually had the experience of someone with all the inside information doing it and still do it. So I think it's the process that you set up as a startup to get serious about learning about customers and validating that learning. That's the advantage you have strategically as a startup that big companies have a very hard time replicating.
In fact, that was probably one of the best science experiments for any startup versus big company. I want to emphasize what Eric said, because almost every engineering-focused startup says, oh, if I tell people name a big company X, we'll go do it. Well, here was the science experiment. Let me emphasize again. Let's just use the word in the class, borrowed the ideas and the founders from day one. The insight is you're wrong on day one. It's like you want them to borrow the plans and the strategy. Give them the source code from day one. Because if they're not set up for learning and discovery, and you are, you're actually going to figure out where the business is. Because I'll guarantee you, it isn't where you thought it was on day one. And here was a science experiment written in the real world about a large company thinking, okay, we got it. All we need to do is execute, build this site, and boom, we'll roll it out. And a startup saying, well, we think we're here, but we're probably wrong. But we've instrumented this thing, and we have an agile process to keep going to actually discover where our business is.
Yeah, by the time they actually managed to launch something, they were building a product that we had already discovered was not the right product 100 iterations ago. But they launched it with such high fanfare and expectations, they were so convinced they got it right, that it was actually the mismatch between the expectations that Google, one of those public companies in the world, put behind this product, and then its pathetic results. It wasn't that they actually, the product wasn't a bad product, and it's not like nobody wanted to use it. Of course, they wanted to use it for stuff that embarrassed Google, but it was that mismatch that really caused them to have to pull it. It was very embarrassing for them. So it was like, even after they launched, they really didn't give it enough time to learn and iterate because they had set the wrong expectations, which is a classic company type.
So I can follow up, there was actually an article in the New York Times about Google showing this and a couple of other products. One of the things that they mentioned about their processes was that they just test things internally before they launch it. And I'm sure that there must be more customer development before that, but just that one, you know, one or two sentence, that made a real impression on me.
Yeah, I mean, Google's got a culture that they know what the answer is. And so they ship it early, but that's because they're so convinced that they know what they're doing. Right, and that's worked really well for them. It's just, when you start to move into some of these more speculative markets like 3D avatars. Okay, I want to actually go through some of these slides because these are, this is kind of some of the facts you already know. I don't see if it was a little bit, didn't mention this exactly, but one of the conditions of us getting Steve's money was that we agreed to audit his class, which was being offered, I think, for the first or second time here at Haas. We thought it was a great deal because we're like, oh, that's all we do is sit in the class and we get $50,000. Okay, fine. But we were down in Palo Alto and Will and I, we would kind of schlep all the way down here. We'd have the whole kind of ride down here sitting in traffic to talk about our business problems of the day. We'd sit in the class and then we'd have the whole trip back to kind of digest and analyze what we saw. And I know that it seems obvious, when you get into this, it's like, oh yeah, duh, right, duh. Talk to customers, get the facts. Like, no, who wouldn't do it that way? But I mean, literally 5 minutes after class, we'd be having an argument about, wait, what did Steve say? And I'd be like, hey, he said we have to, ship this thing right now. And Will would be like, that's not what he said. Really? So it, in the real world, the level of confusion is exponentially higher than even you can get the chance to see in the case. It's really tough. So doing these exercises and kind of drilling it now, it really pays off later. I wish we had done more of that. We shipped the product 6 months. You know that we charged from day one. We did no press releases.
Tell them about the press release story.
I don't want to tell that story.
You finally did one.
What's that? Yes. The company did officially launch just at the end of 2008. So if you do the math, that's 4.5 years after we founded it. But we did have one press article. Wired Magazine called us up that first year when we were still auditing Steve's class. They wanted to run an article about the future of instant messaging. And it was like, the future of instant messaging is 3D. And AOL's got this new initiative, and there's this new company called InView. So we were like, oh my God, we're in the same article as AOL, and they're saying that we're the next big thing. That was in the days when it was still cool to be compared to AOL. which is a big issue, because like I wish I could remove that article now. And we were like, we took the call. You know, we had a nope, we didn't know any press, no press, but like Wired magazine was calling. Yeah, we took the call. So we did it. They did this great article. It was very complimentary about how we were going to beat AOL. But we were even better than their offering. And all this stuff about the product. And I remember we were sitting right here, and we would audit the class, and we had the article with us. And we were, after class, came up to Joe Steve, hey, you know, this is, you know, months, we're getting $300 a month, we're not making any progress according to traditional metrics. We thought this would make him feel good about his investment. And that's all I really remember for that day. didn't go that well. Steve was... Well, there's two reasons. First is, it was a complete wasted opportunity because we were totally not ready to capitalize on the traffic that article generated. You know, it sent a bunch of people to our site, it overloaded our servers, and like we didn't yet know how to monetize our product, right? There's the same mistake we made there, only this lot tinier. And I think the bigger issue was that article positions InView entirely wrong, because it turns out that everything you read in the case about InView is an instant messaging product and IM add-on, and that all turned out to be wrong. InView is actually not an instant messaging product, although it has an instant messaging component. It's a social networking product. We had never heard of social networking at that time. I mean, MySpace hadn't yet been acquired by News Corp, and it wasn't, you know, my social networking met Friendster, which was a fad, if you can even remember that concept. We had no clue. And so if I could go back and take that article and zap it out of existence, I would. Because all the great things they say about InView is establishing a wrong positioning for the product. That, God forbid, any of our customers were to see, it would give them the wrong idea and it would attract the wrong customer. Basically, you know, it just more work for us later to have to go out and undo that positioning. Luckily, it turned out that nobody read that article.
So,
you know, could have been otherwise.
Truly, there was a great point there for both Will and Eric for years, because they couldn't sit down by the time I was done with them. And you will hear too. Once you launch a product, that rocket has left the pad, meaning you are spending Earth burning your positioning into people's brains. And if you launch prematurely, it's an ICBM. You don't get to call it back and say, I was just kidding. You know, or, oh, no, we have a better positioning. Why don't you write another story about us in the New York Times? You know how often that happens? You know, maybe when you shoot somebody or your building blows up, but the odds of you getting another launch story going, if you gets their positioning correct, a year and a half later, it's never going to happen. And so I wasn't mad that they got a story. I just was mad that they didn't think through about what would happen if they weren't correct about their positioning. And the odds of you being correct after 4 months of your company is probably close to zero. And so it was just, can you imagine telling Wired, hey, listen, we're really in stealth mode. We love you guys. We are a leader in this space, but we don't want to talk to them. Oh, man, they would have liked been even 10x more interested in me calling you every week. Rather than you just blew it and they weren't interested in talking to you for another 3 years.
Yeah, in fact, if you look at the press coverage that InView got in 2008, 4 years after we made that mistake, there's no Wired write-up. They already wrote the article. They need to write it again. So those prejudices stick. So premature launch.
So don't tell me that you got a Wired article.
Yeah, definitely don't do that. So these are slides that are full from a presentation that Steve and I did for a VC firm to talk about some of the principles that we're trying to abstract out of cases like InView around a concept that we're calling a lean startup. And what I want to do is really focus on the parts of the presentation that answer this question of what's the process by which you make sense of this kind of signal-to-noise problem. So I don't need to tell you too much about this, but things have changed a little bit. So all of a sudden, the lean startup is starting to sound like a pretty good idea when 2-3 years ago, cash was plentiful, credits everywhere. You need to raise another $10 million. It wasn't actually that hard. All of a sudden, we're in a changed reality where the mistakes that companies are making are being punished a lot sooner. You know, this will sound familiar from the there part of the case. This is a traditional thing. High burn rate. Venture investors, their incentives are all about swing for the fences. They want the next Google, the next Amazon, the next eBay. And actually, that kind of makes sense for their economics, but not so much as a founder, because it's all or nothing for you. And if you miss, you know, they'll shoot the company and move on. But that's, you know, 4 years of your life down the drain. And they live through that. It's not that fun. Build a full management team ahead of time. You know, hire the Jamie Bell. Figure out, you know, once you have the idea, core idea here, you know, assume you know what the customer is, you do the analysis on the whiteboard, figure out the perfect strategy, you figure out the features that they're going to want, you basically assume that execution will win for startups. And if you take anything away from this class, I hope it will be that startups are not just little big companies. And so successful execution in a big company doesn't look like successful execution in a startup. It's just a different thing. So we've been looking for a metaphor for how to talk about this, about what is it that's wrong with traditional startups. So I think, see if we actually get some multimedia here. Here we go, yeah.
Coming in, guys, coming in. Hey, that bogey's still behind you. I've been going for a shot. Stay with him, man, stay with him. Take the shot, nail him, nail him. Shit, ice, I can't get it home. Shoot, Maverick, I can't get him off my tail.
Actually grounded in an actual historical event, which is this guy named John Boyd. Anyone heard of him? John Boyd? Anybody? Good. Not that well-known a figure, as you can see, but he really changed the course of modern warfare. He was a guy in the Korean War. He flew fighter pilots, which is basically this scene in Top Gun is loosely based. And the nice thing about dogfights and fighter pilots is it's a really pure combat scenario where it's very simple. You can shoot things that are in front of you. So if you can be behind the other plane, you can shoot it down. And if he can be behind you, he can shoot you down. So that's it. That's what determines the outcome of a dogfight. And what Boyd figured out when he was actually flying these planes for a living was that what mattered in terms of your ability to get behind another plane was not how fast your plane could go. It was not how heavy the plane was. It wasn't the kind of firepower you took. All these kind of traditional variables that have been used to evaluate quality of fighter planes. But it was this concept he called agility. That is, it was the responsiveness of the plane to the pilot's intentions and the ability of the pilot and the plane together as a whole unit to react to what his enemy was doing that would allow him to get behind him faster. And he actually worked out the mathematics of it and helped the U.S. Air Force build better planes and a lot of interesting stuff. But later, he generalized that concept into a theory of modern warfare called maneuver warfare, based around this concept called the OODA loop. And, you know, the OODA loop is really not about warfighting anymore, although it's very useful in that context. It is a theory for how human beings come together to take collective action, how they can do that better than other groups of human beings who have the same objective. And so when we think about it in business, it's a theory for how do we build an organization that can outmaneuver the competition. And it has four basic steps. Every person in the organization and the organization as a whole is trying to observe what's going on in reality, orient themselves to what it means, take decisions, and then make decisions and then take action that could affect that environment. And his insight, the kind of core insight, is what matters is not how well you do any one of these four things. What matters is the speed at which you can execute this feedback loop. That is, whoever gets... the winners are those who can move faster than their competitors. So, you know, Steve and I and others have been thinking about how do we apply this concept of agility to startups? How can we figure out systematically, how can we build a system that allows a company to iterate faster? And so if you look at the InView operating manual and kind of all the specific practices we tried to adopt there, this was the core goal, was to take in data about what's going on and make responses as quickly as possible. So we were talking to VCs at the time, so we had to, you know, make sure that they understand that it's not just, you know, like in big companies, iteration is helpful, and there's, you know, lots of movements to get people to iterate faster in a big company context where we basically kind of know the terrain. But the problem with a startup is that it's extremely disoriented. That's what we try to get at in the case, that you really don't know what you don't know. And so getting oriented to the landscape is really key. And it's not possible to do it at your desk. So we think that the OODA loop, you know, it's represented by this concept of global lean startup. It's basically a combination of Steve's customer development process, which is about having an iterative process for the marketing and business part of your company to figure out who's a customer for this product, combined with something called agile software development, agile product development, if you generalize it, which is a new way of building product development teams themselves for rapid iteration. So I'll try to talk a little bit about what that looks like, but here are the basic ideas. Continuous customer interaction. So at InView, it wasn't that we would run a focus group and then make a decision, but we had gotten that feedback loop of getting data from customers into a continuous mode. I'll talk about some of the techniques we use for that. That meant that every day new feedback was coming in, every day we were processing it, every day we were making new releases of the software, usually multiple times a day, to run experiments to try to collect data about, hey, is this what's going on? Is that what's going on? We had revenue to goals from day one. We didn't scale the product until, we didn't sell a company's cost until we had revenue to generate it. And of course, we assumed that everything we thought we knew about the company, all the assumptions that we had baked in, were unknowns. So we were low burn by design. What's key about the lean startup idea, I think, is that it allows you to do more than just cut costs. Because every lean and, you know, things are tight, you're like, oh, we want the burn rate to be as low as possible. But once you understand that your goal is to really, the progress in your startup means learning about customers, really understanding what motivates them and what will make them give you money, you can then go through your budget line by line, person by person, piece of equipment by piece of equipment, and ask yourself this question. Does this expense help me learn about what I need to know about my customers for this company to be successful? And if not, you can actually cut costs in a way that make you go faster through this feedback loop. So here's what we did. You already know this stuff. One of the things I thought would be helpful is to actually walk you through a couple slides from our original fundraising deck, the actual slides that we took into venture investors when we had a pathetically small amount of revenue, let's admit, and we were asking them for multi-million dollars to invest in our company. And one of the things I thought would be helpful is that try to see it from their perspective and try to think about the narrative that we're telling them and see if you would have found it compelling. So first of all, think about it with just this graph here. I don't know if you can actually, is this readable? You can see what's going on here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is a revenue and active users graph. For those that can't see too well, this, I believe, starts out at about $500. This is monthly revenue. It goes up all the way to $7,500 in monthly revenue in August of 2005, when we were actually pitching VC investors. So putting this slide up, like in our advisory board meeting that Steve was talking about, we would often get asked if there were zeros missing. Like, is this in thousands? And you have $7 million of revenue? That would be exciting in a month, right? But no, $7,000. So going in, we were facing a disadvantage that we had this hockey stick shape, but it was a little bit fake. You know, the scale is just so small, it's considered insignificant. But here's how we try to use that to our advantage. We told people what the product was. Just a little detail, it's not in the case. Our first product was actually not a standalone instant messaging network or like a social network. It was actually a instant messaging add-on that would interoperate with basically every IM client under the planet. So you didn't have to download a whole new IM network. You didn't have to have a separate buddy list. You could just use it with your existing friends, your existing networks, no extra startup costs. Does that make sense? Like, why you want to do that? Right, it's good strategy, right? Everybody knows you can't bring a new IM network to market, right? Why? Who said network effects before? So I was talking about network effects, how important they are in this business. Yeah, right? Because network effects, the IM business, right? The more people who are on the network, the more people you can talk to, that makes the network exponentially more valuable, right? Everyone with me so far? And we all know that there's high switching costs within instant messaging, because once you're invested in a specific network where your buddies are, you'd have to get them all to switch with you to the new network, right? And, of course, that creates this huge barrier to entry. Nobody can bring a new instant messaging network to bear because the incumbents are so well-saturated. Everyone already has an instant messaging network. That was the whiteboard exercise that we did to define Imbue's brilliant strategy. We were pretty proud of ourselves, and when we talked to MBAs and stuff like that, they're always like, oh, yeah, everyone's like, that sounds like a good strategy. And what's cool about it is I can now tell you with complete confidence that every one of the statements I just made about that strategy is empirically verifiably false. Is 100% incorrect. There are no network effects, there are no switching costs, and there's no barrier to entry. It's completely wrong. At least for the kind of instant messaging product that we were trying to bring to market. And we'll talk a little bit about why if anyone's interested. But we tried really hard to make it work. We could not get the data to match the theory, no matter how hard we tried. And that was the story we came in telling investors. Basically, people loved the 3D avatar part of this, but they found the add-on concept completely confusing. We would bring in like a teenager to, you know, for a usability test. We'd be like, all right, download this instant messaging add-on. They'd be like, what's that? They're like, you know, it's going to interoperate. We're going to interoperate. They're like, is it an instant messaging client? We're like, well, sort of. They're like, okay, am I going to have my own buddy list? No, you won't need your own buddy list. It's that much better. And they're looking at us like, what are you talking about? We're like, all right, fine. Try it anyway. Trust us, you're going to like it. So they would download the software. They create an avatar, which they really like. They're like, oh, it's fun, you know, dressing up, choosing my kind of custom identity. And then they'd have the product running, and we would say, okay, now invite one of your friends to try this thing with you. And they'd be like, no way. Well, why not? You know, you don't have to learn a whole new thing. It's instantly viral because when you invite someone, we had this whole system where they would send them an invite link. They'd click the link. It would magically make the software work, and they'd be chatting with you in 3D. And it was a total deal breaker. We could not get any teenagers to try to, like, inflict an unknown product on one of their friends and risk their own social capital and standing with their friends on this thing they didn't know if it was cool yet. And so we tried everything under the sun to try to make that seal the deal there. And the answer was they had absolutely no interest in doing it. They always wanted to say, we want to try it first ourselves without having to kind of risk bringing one of our friends in. And so we tried a bunch of stuff. We built a single player mode, basically. We were in the video game industry, so when people said try it first, that's what we thought they meant. And so you can imagine this teenager. So you got us sitting in the computer in our office. They'd make the avatar. Okay, that was fun. So, okay, now try it by yourself. And they'd make the avatar dance and do all the moves. And they'd be like, okay, that's okay. And they'd be like, all right, now invite one of your friends. No. Why not? They're like, it's not that cool. Like, we told you it wasn't going to be that cool. Right? It's a social product. It requires inviting one of your friends to get how cool it was. And it was still a deal breaker, right? They're not interested. And eventually, grudgingly, like, kicking and screaming, we're like, fine. We'll make a feature where you can try it with a stranger so that you can kind of see what the experience would be like with two people. And that was actually a breakthrough feature for us because it allowed people to basically try what the experience would be like with somebody else who had something in common with them. What's the thing they have in common? They're both a little bit weird, and they're willing to take a chance on a 3D avatar project, which, after all, is not the most mainstream concept, especially in 2004. And then we had another problem, which is then they would say, well, I want to add this person to my buddy list. I just met someone cool I like, and that was fun. And we'd say, well, listen, you don't want your own buddy list, right, because of interoperability and network effects and switching costs. And they're like, huh? So just give them your AIM screen name or your MSN screen name and put them on that buddy list. And I'm like, stranger on my AIM buddy list? You got to be kidding me. So, I mean, our concept of what teenagers would and would not find difficult to do was totally wrong. And that actually turned out to be true in all age demographics. That original product concept was horribly, horribly flawed, thanks to our brilliant strategic analysis. So we threw it away. As an engineer, speaking as a guy who wrote the 50,000 lines of code required to do the IM interoperability, this was an extremely painful thing to do. You can imagine how reluctant I was to conclude that it's not just that the UI is hard to use, it's not just that, you know, blah, blah, blah. No, we actually built the wrong product. And I wish I could have those 6 months of my life back. And I want to mention that because we were not pro metrics from the start. We actually, as an engineer, I'm like, building metrics is a waste of time. Our customers don't care if we have good metrics. They just want a good product. You want me to build reports? Waste. I'm anti-waste. I'm all about lean. Metrics equals waste. But because we had set up, you made that previous decision that we were going to have that $300 a month revenue plan, and we were going to make sure that we were selling the product early, that put us in a situation where necessity was the mother of invention. So as stubborn as I want it to be about metrics or no metrics, at the end of the day, we could ask, do we make any money today? Did we hit our $30 a day for $10 a day quota for that month? And of course, in these days, the answer was no. Someone talked about the $5 a day AdWords campaign, right? That was key. We were paying 5 cents a click, bringing 100 human beings to our website every day. I was the VP of marketing in those days. And if I'd had any training in marketing, I would have known that that was a waste of time because 100 clicks a day, insignificant, right? Too small to be even worth doing. But I was an engineer. I didn't know any better. To me, that meant 100 human beings were trying our product. And I was like, so probably 50 of them will buy it. Some people here done direct marketing, right? I mean, our expectation was totally out of whack. And so the answer was zero of them bought it. And every day, 100 people come in, nobody buys. And we started to be like, all right, maybe there's a problem with the payment processing. It's too hard to use. We make a fix in payments. Nobody buys the product. All right, well, maybe they're downloading it and they're loving it a lot, but they don't know that they're supposed to pay. Right? That's the problem. We make that a little bit more obvious. No, that's still zero. And we start to instrument these stages, and we eventually learn about funnel analysis and all that stuff you invent. Yeah?
I'm just curious, this lesson that you learned, from hindsight's perspective, is there something you could have done to learn that more quickly, or do you think that 6 months?
I mean, listen, InVue today ships software about 50 times a day. So that means we have, on average, I don't know the exact numbers, but 30 or 40 split test experiments running at any one time about, you know, both like little features, like should this button be here or there, but also macro things, like should the business model look like this, or this model look like that. And so the speed at which we would evaluate an idea like this now, I mean, would be a matter of days. This is such a bad idea, you can figure it out in 2 or 3 days. But yeah, so the fact that it took us 6 months is a little bit embarrassing. All I can say in our defense was at least it was better than the 5 years it took us the previous time. So we thought, hey, that's at least an order of magnitude improvement, right? Right? So that's the best we could do in those days. But no, don't hold yourself to the standard of figuring out 6 months. Find it out sooner, please. That kind of constant failure of not selling is how we learn how to instrument a product, kind of kicking and screaming. And again, only to do the absolute minimum instrumentation that was absolutely necessary to figure out why is nobody buying. Anyone done direct marketing, you know, on a landing page, of course. Yeah.
Isn't it true that you needed those 100 users as measly as they were and they were not paying you? Would you have had enough traffic if you were not spending the $5 on Google AdWords?
No, definitely not. No, listen, we picked our $300 sales target. That was calculated by taking our average selling price that we thought it would be, multiplied times all the friends and family we could kind of enumerate that we thought could twist their arms into buying our product. And we weren't that popular. We ran out of friends awfully fast. Getting even friends and family to pull out their credit card to buy your crappy product. Not easy as it sounds on paper anyway. Is there someone else have that? So anyway, so that was, you know, this is the story we're telling to VCs, which is, look, we may not have the best product idea in the world, but we are iterative. So we're willing to learn from our mistakes. So we talked about this next period. I won't go through in as much detail here, but we built that chat now, that instant match feature I was talking about. And we started to hear this problem that it's kind of like people would hit the chat now and want to chat with somebody else, but there'd be nobody there. So it was kind of an instant gratification problem, which we solved just by scaling up our advertising budget to a whopping $40 a day. Now we were really spending. And if you notice, there's this big jump here, this continuous jump. It seems like, ooh, hockey stick, right? But we're spending 8 times more money every day to bring new customers to the site. So this isn't actually that interesting. And in fact, through this whole period, we're spending more money on advertising every period than we were the period before. So a hockey stick, don't be confused. It's not 100% organic growth. And in fact, when we would talk to VCs in this phase, we would disclaim this thing like you wouldn't believe. We were engineers, so we were embarrassed that this was not a 100% organic hockey stick. You know, because we were cheating. We were buying traffic. We were engaging in marketing. Right? and the VCs didn't care. I mean, we couldn't disclaim this thing enough. There was no way for us to convince them that a hockey stick is not a hockey stick. Because they understood, even though we didn't, that if there's 8,000 customers were active in a given month, and you made $8,000, no matter how badly you're cheating, you're making $1 per customer per month. And although you may only have 8,000 of them now, if you have 10 million of them one day, then you're going to make $10 million per month. And that's a pretty good business. So it was actually their insight, more than ours, and Steve's, to be fair, that the hockey stick means something, even if you feel like, gosh, it's supposed to happen a certain way, and should be all viral or whatever. So, you know, we had, at this point, we had started to be like, hey, maybe this whole social networking thing is starting to be important then. Oh, and usually I have a slide that shows the next 6 months of growth after this. After we raised money, you know, 6 months later, we're gone from $8,000 to like $80,000 a month. So we're doing pretty well, yeah.
So why why were you looking for VC money at this time?
We were not. Steve, it was Steve's idea. It was just talking to VCs. We were like, oh, no VCs will be interested. But one of the concepts we had was we were pretty suspicious of VC involvement from our previous. You know, talking about the overreaction. We had seen VCs kind of gone bad, and we weren't sure that we wanted to be involved with them anymore. So we put ourselves in a position where we always had the option of raising VC money, but we never had to. So at this point, we actually were at a point with this low burn and actually starting to get some traction, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a month. For a company burning $40,000 a month, that's pretty good. We treated each round of financing as what we call a bridge to profitability, meaning it was not a bridge to the next round, which is how it was at Thera. You raise your A, achieve some milestones, raise your B, raise your C, raise your D. Basically make your investors into your customers instead of your customers are your customers. We didn't want to make that mistake. What we discovered was once we had the option to take money or not, A, we got way better terms, because VCs never want to give you money when you need the money, because you made some kind of mistake earlier that they're helping you. Gee, but also it meant that we could have a conversation about, and this was the conversation we had at the end of that case, which of these options allows us to achieve our vision better? It was that simple. We had this, we were on a mission to change the way people, I don't know how we would have described it then, now I would say build social capital online. That was important to us. There's a lot of lonely people in this world, and we felt we could give them a way to connect with other like-minded people that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. So that was important to us, and we wanted to know which of these three options, which of any of the options we ever presented would help us do it better. And when we did the, when we ran the numbers, you know what? With $8 million in the bank, we could do a lot more of this, and we could do some good, and we could build a very profitable business on that round.
So we did. Just as an aside before Eric goes on with the presentation, these three slides, if you notice, look like no VC pitch you've probably seen. Not about the product, not about the technology, even though there were intro slides about let us tell you about the virtual world market was all about a set of failures for other companies. But this really said something unique. And it scared off, I'd say, 50% of the VCs. But I can't tell you how well this resonates with the other set. In fact, Eric could tell you. What it does is it says about five things. One, it says we know how to listen and iterate and be agile in a way you've never seen before. And no, we're not going to blow your money on just dumb execution. And we're a smart bunch of guys who, so far, have listened well, understand how to articulate what we heard, and also understand on how to change our product based on what, where the customers are. And damn it, if they're out there, we're going to go find them. And so you've gone from $300 a month to why were all these VCs chasing these guys on Facebook? You can read the chart as well as anybody else on $8,000 a month. And basically what Eric was telling them was a customer development story without ever using the word customer development. Think about it. It's we did discovery, we did validation, we think we're now ready to do some execution, but never had to sell the religion, just had to show them what the practice was. Sorry.
Yeah, no, we I remember one VC who I won't name. We come and we give him this whole pitch. He's like, oh, we love the Steve Blank approach. You guys are all Steve Blank, plus, double plus, great. So listen, you guys need to create some MRDs. And we're like, talk to Steve recently? Like, oh, yeah, he's going to think this is great. And they're like, yes, throw away this whole iterative. I don't know where you got that, but Steve's going to love the marketing plan we're going to build for you. And look, it's not that easy when someone's like offering to give you a lot of money to kind of like to feel like, oh, gosh, do I really want to say no? I have such a principled belief in how companies should be run that I'm willing to say no. And I don't know exactly what gave us that. I'm not sure it was that well-founded, but we had it, and it worked out well. And even when we made mistakes, we made them confidently, and therefore we learned from it. Because if you're not willing to kind of put yourself out there and go out on a limb and try something you didn't think, you weren't sure if it was going to work, you basically can't learn anything. So that was the fundraising pitch. And then, so back to this question about lean startup. I want to just say a couple of, like, a little bit more practical things about how we actually built this company for iteration. I promise I would get to that. And so there's kind of three big trends that the lean startup leverages. The first is technology commoditization. So that, even people who are, like, serious engineering managers 10 years ago or 15 years ago, the landscape has really changed in terms of the capabilities that you can bring online into a startup really easily that gives you just substantially higher leverage. By which I mean for every line of code you write, you're leveraging, hundreds of thousands of lines of code that other people in the free and open source communities have written. that cloud computing vendors have written. When you want to talk to customers, you don't have to go sign a big deal. You put your $5 on AdWords, so it's highly leveraged. This thing called Agile management. Has anyone here actually done Agile software development? A few people. What's cool about Agile, it really has been very successful in big companies. All of the original Agile thinkers developed it in a situation really for big companies. And when people have tried to apply it to startups, it hasn't always worked out that well. So I think there's a better way to adapt Agile to the startup situation. And, of course, customer development, the full process that you guys are talking about here. And, again, if you take anything away from what I'm talking about, test your assumptions, test those hypotheses, have a system for doing that. So, I already said at Envy we were shipping software 50 times a day, and that's not a joke. That's real. And we weren't just engaged in what they call cowboy coding, where it's like, change it and hope for the best. To do that, to ship software at that pace in such a way that you don't take the site down, you don't negatively impact revenue in a big way, you don't introduce bug regressions and kind of have all kinds of quality messes, is actually quite hard and requires a real dedication to this concept of getting to the root cause of what's wrong and really doing continuous improvement of your process. And the whole point of that was not just to do it for its own sake to produce high-quality software, but really to have an integrated feedback loop with customer development so that we could, as fast as we could think up experiments to run, we could run them. It wasn't a big delay. We had a big meeting to kind of decide. Oftentimes, people would come to the big planning meeting with results of an experiment they had already run on some pet idea that they had shown to 5% of customers, done the split test, to discover that that would make us more money. And like, if you've ever been in one of those big product management planning meetings where everyone's lobbying for their idea and there's no facts in the room, like an oxygen-depleted environment, the difference, like, you don't have to have a discussion when someone's like, listen, I know exactly how much this feature is worth to us. And it's going to take this amount of time to build, because I've already built the prototype and I've already tested the response of customers. I won't say a lot about commoditized technology because I feel like that's a topic that's been well traveled. What I will say is I think people have gotten the idea that by using free and open source software and all these other things, you can lower costs. But what I don't think has been as well understood is that you can, instead of lowering costs, you can increase speed. And that's actually more important. The speed at which you can put together a complete end-to-end prototype of a new website, for example, including full marketing plan, customer buy, revenue, the works, the whole thing. I mean, people are building whole products like that in weeks, days and weeks, not months and years. So if used correctly, you can really use it to accelerate your pace of development. And if you're talking about development methodologies, it's traditional to start by beating up on the waterfall development methodology. So I thought I would start there. This will look familiar, I think, to a lot of you. This is still, unfortunately, a lot of startups even still run this way, where you have siloed departments, each have a certain specialty. Business guys figure out, hey, here's what we need to do. Product managers prioritize and write specs, which are handed to a design team who write the mock-ups and do the usability testing, hand them to programmers who write the software, which is handed to QA who certifies it, and it's handed to operations who deploys it. And there are situations where that process works. I mean, when you're building the space shuttle, you don't do it iteratively because it blows up if you don't get it right the first time. So, but situations like that are really about known problem, known solution. And if you think about what's the unit of progress, like at VAIR, we spent 5 years building a product using Waterfall, textbook, and lots of startups. How do you know that you're making progress? You can't ship anything for 2 years, so you're 9 months in. How do you know you've actually made any progress? The answer is because you've advanced through the stages. So when you complete a design, you celebrate. You hand it off to the next stage. When you figure out where you start an initiative, you plan out all the events that are supposed to happen, all the handoffs, you put them on a giant Gantt chart. And every time a thing happens on schedule, you call that success. What I call that now is achieving a failure. That is, you've successfully executed the plan, and so you celebrate. Instead of asking yourself, was that a good plan in the first place? And that's why Waterfall especially, I think, is inappropriate for startups. For those of you who've tried extreme programming or another agile software development methodology, this is the traditional, this is the place where it really excels. You have a known problem, but an unknown solution. So
how many of you use some agile methodology? Anybody raise your hand
time. Your programming? Do you have a customer in the room at the time?
We have a product owner.
Product owner? Anyone have an actual customer sitting in the room with them? That aren't agile. Extreme programming, anyway, would say, when you're building software, you always have an end user sitting with you to answer your questions. So So like the canonical example is you're building a big accounting system, you know, for a big corporation. They've got this old legacy version that runs on COBOL or something, and you're going to bring it up to modern standards. So you would actually have a member of the accounting department. Their desk is physically located next to the engineers who are building it so that they have a question about, hey, should this thing work like this, work like that? They don't have to go through 12 levels of approval to get it answered. They can have it answered instantaneously. And for situations like that where you're building a system where the specification is extremely well understood, this is really great. These teams deliver software at way higher cost, way higher quality, much lower cost than the kind of more traditional thing. A lot of traditional software projects, I mean, they outright never complete, let alone come in way over budget. So this is great, but you ask, think about for a startup, who's the customer? Who do you want to have sitting in the office with you? You know, at InView, we would have tried to get a like middle-aged housewife to sit there and answer our questions, but we wouldn't have even known what questions to ask. And we certainly would have had the wrong person, and you might say, okay, well, then just as you go through a succession of different customers, but the level of chaos is too high for that to work. And so this is kind of our attempt to put a schematic diagram against what this kind of customer development engineering looks like, where you've got the business and marketing team running customer development, going through these iterative stages, generating continuously new hypotheses, kind of insights about customers, what they think they know, and therefore new hypotheses that they want to test, which are kind of continuously flowing into your engineering organization, who are themselves trying to test those hypotheses and send data back. Hey, here's a split test that shows that that insight is basically wrong. But who are themselves having their own insights, passing data back to the business and marketing folks. So if you go back to this diagram, you ask, what's the unit of progress in an agile software development environment? The radical idea here is that a unit of progress is a line of working code. So if you write a specification or you documentation or you build any other kind of artifact, that might be necessary, but not doesn't count as progress. Never celebrate that. You only celebrate when you actually manage to deploy something into production that works. And that's great, but think about the 40,000 lines of code that we wrote for IAM interoperability. And I had unit tests for that code, for those who know what I'm talking about. I mean, that was continuously integrated. It was very high-quality software that did IAM interoperability. But the problem was, it was still 100% waste, because that feature wasn't important to any customers. So we're trying to take our thinking up a level to say, what can we do to prevent ourselves from engaging in wasteful activities? That is, activities that don't contribute to customer validation. Is really what startups are about. So, customer development, I won't go too much into this, you're here to learn that, and you're learning from the master. But the idea is that you have a parallel process to customer development happening on the engineering team, and constant communication flowing back and forth, versus the kind of more traditional model, which is you have linear execution in your product team. Because, you know, engineers, they get a little scared if you start to change the customer on them and the spec, and they work better if you could just hide all that confusion from them so they can just linearly execute, right? That's more efficient, keeps everybody busy. But keeping everybody busy is not our goal. Our goal is to learn about customers. So here we have a parallel process. And
question over here.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Just curious about the implementation of this customer in the room. I'm interested in how you guys did that.
Yeah, we don't have time for me to go into too much detail, but I'll just give you a couple of anecdotes. The first is we actually didn't operate with a customer in the room all the time. That just, I don't think that's right for a startup. Maybe in limited cases where you really are bringing an existing product to an existing market and you're just doing it better, faster, cheaper. But even then, I think there are better techniques. To me, the gold standard is split testing. That is actually having some customers see one version of your product and other customers see another. And then using a little science to say, look, this is the control group. This is the experimental treatment. Let's see, was their behavior any different? And that's obviously really easy to do on the web, but it's possible to do in all other environments as well. To me, that's the key way to check hypothesis, to find out if it's any good. The flip side of it, though, is what if you don't know what hypothesis to test? So we would often find ourselves, we would run 10 split test experiments to try to get people to buy our software, and they would all fail. It would all show no difference between treatment and control. In fact, most of them would make it worse. So we go from, you know, minimal revenue to down to zero. So it's like, okay, that's not a good variation. We would quite often run out of ideas. We weren't that creative. Especially when you know your idea is going to actually be tested. It's not just going to be evaluated by how good it sounds. And that's where these other more qualitative kinds of customer feedback are really important. Who was talking about the kind of all that noise of all the different feedback from the different sources? that's when we would just kind of drink from the fire hose. So we had a full-time customer liaison. That was our employee number six. This guy had no other job but to full-time, all day long, bring feedback from customers to the development team. If we caught him doing anything else, he was fired. So he would, for example, we would track every 2 weeks of customers were a cohort, and then we would send them a regular tracking survey, you know, at the end of 2 weeks all the time to kind of ask them the same set of questions. We would bring customers in about 3 times a week for an in-person usability test. Talked about those experiences with a teenager who's like, hello, old man, right? We actually, that's not hypothetical. We really did that. I mean, I never heard of MySpace in my life until I started asking customers, what product does this remind you of? And I would always thought they would say The Sims, you know, the video game. They would say There or Second Life. Our customers never heard of Second Life. They were like, oh, this is just like MySpace. First of all, we're like, what's that? And they're like, you don't know. Right? You know what MySpace is? Because even in 2004, all American teenagers, as far as I can tell, were doing their social life on MySpace. We never heard of. But also, MySpace and MDU don't have a lot in common. From a features point of view, especially in those days, there was no social networking component at all to MDU. But the key insight we eventually figured out is to remember that customers don't think of competitive products in terms of features. They only think in terms of benefits. So if two products give them the same benefit, they'll name them as competitors, even if they share no features in common. So it was a lot of in-person conversations. We would look at that cohort data. We would get very lively forums. If you run a community site, especially, you've got to have active engagement with your most passionate customers. So we would have flame wars erupt all the time. One rule we had was every engineer, when they would ship a new feature, they would have to go to the forums under their own name. Hi, my name's Eric. I just shipped this feature, and here's what it does. That was an open thread with comments. So first of all, half the time, you have people right in there and be like, well, thanks, Eric. You're a complete jerk. I hate your guts. You ruined my birthday party. You know, you get the full vitriol that you see on the internet when nobody knows that you're a dog, right? But also, a lot of times, you post, and there'd be the sound of crickets. Nobody cares. You just shipped this feature you think is the best thing since sliced bread is going to change everything, and nobody even takes the time to tell you it sucks. That's when you know you have a bad feature in your hands. I mean, we did just tons of stuff like that. The point
Eric,
was...
Did you require the product automatically to do anything to get data back?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean,
What were the top five things?
Yeah, well, first of all, the basic metrics of retention analysis and cohort analysis funnel stuff. I mean, if anyone's interested in the mechanics of that, that's a really important thing to understand. There's some great resources online for kind of got to do that. You got to look at retention over time. That is your product retaining more and more users kind of on a per customer basis each time period? Kind of look at that. That's really important. We use something called Net Promoter Score, which is a research methodology that comes out of the service industry for evaluating how passionate people are about your customer, kind of measuring customer satisfaction in a kind of non-intuitive way, which you do by kind of doing a continuous tracking survey where every day a certain number of our active users are asked the same one question on a survey. And the other thing we did is we did a lot of fake features. So we had a system where we could kind of at will pop a dialog box for some customers in the product that would be like, hey, do you want to try this new feature? You know, do you want to try, you know, flying bats in your room? We would often do that when we didn't have flying bats. If you clicked yes, it would be like, oh, sorry, there's a technical glitch not working right. But whatever, we'd often make up excuses. We used to worry a lot about what the excuses would be, too, to make sure they were plausible, until we realized that 99% of the time, the number of people who click on the new feature is zero. So they never saw the excuse, so it really didn't matter what it was. Yeah?
Do you offer any benefits to the people that you work with studies, like credits or whatever?
Oh, yeah. I don't even want to get too much into the mechanics because it almost doesn't matter. Depending on who you're trying to talk to, you have to do different things to reach them. And I have developed quite the confidence of wasting all this space in my brain about exactly how to do that for different customers. But I'm reluctant to even share it because if you put yourself in a situation where you need that data, you will discover those tricks. Like, you want to talk to customers who have churned out of your product? Very important. Why did you churn out? Sending them an email that says, hey, why did you churn out? You don't get any responses because of the people that churned out. They hate your guts. They never want to hear from you again. So, you know, we would offer contests for free iPod and all kinds of stuff. If you would just please talk to us for a few minutes and just tell us, what did you think of our product? Why, you know?
I had a question about, as you rapidly iterate and as your customer feedback perhaps evolves over time or with what customers expect, how do you resolve, like, changes that you've made in the past that you might be returning to? Or, you know, how do you keep track of what
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. The question is kind of how do you keep track of all these different changes and what's gone on? The answer is we really didn't. We used to think a lot that what would be really, really valuable, we have a big kind of complete timeline of every change that we made. We're engineers, right? You can imagine how complicated we made this thing. So we had a timeline that would automatically measure all key metrics and kind of annotate with this feature launched on this day and that feature launched on that day. But it would be easy to forget that the point is not to do the exercise and like prove that you're right. The point is two things. One, to actually be right. And two, to learn, have your organization be learning. So what we actually discovered was, since everyone in the company, down to the receptionist, everyone was required to engage in these activities and be trying experiments and learning, and then sharing their learnings with others, the human beings involved were actually building in their brains pretty good heuristics about what worked and what didn't. So, you know, occasionally someone would be like, hey, we should try an experiment for blah, and someone else would be like, no, we tried that 3 months ago and it didn't work. And sometimes they would be like, okay, fine, forget it. But sometimes the other person would say, you know, that might be true, but I think something's changed. We should run the experiment again. And because like, running experiments was incredibly cheap in our system, we would just do it. Be like, you want to run the experiment? Go for it. No experiment is too crazy or stupid to try as many times as you want. Like I told you about the 40,000 lines of code I wrote for IAM interoperability. That's a feature our investors asked for so many times. We built it from scratch a second time, about 18 months in, and it was just as big a dud the second time as it was the first time. So please don't build features for investors. Most features that everyone in Silicon Valley loves, and that's the only people who think it's a good idea. That's your question.
I think that one more slide up here.
So yeah, so we want to find the VCs, the next wave of capital efficiency. And yeah, that's it. I'll take more questions.
How did you go about making the customers pay for a beta product?
Just ask. I mean. Well, see, that's interesting. You don't make customers do anything, ever. In fact, that's a lethal idea, because the engineers especially have this problem. It's like stupid customers that just don't understand our great vision. Like, we need to educate them. There's nothing engineers love more than educating users about what the right way to behave is and the new thing that they need to learn with tutorials and manuals and, you know, that's all I'm talking about. It doesn't work that way. What you can do is offer customers an exchange of value. I'll give you something if you give me something in return. And see who takes it. And what's interesting about early adopters is the exchange of value is a little bit non-intuitive. It is not true that the first customers who bought our product, it's not right to say they were giving us money in exchange for the bits that we shipped to their computer. Because frankly, the bits we were shipping were pretty crap. We were embarrassed. I mean, as the VP of engineering, to have to constantly ship low-quality software, this was not fun for my professional reputation or my ease of sleeping at night. But we did it anyway because we had to. And what we discovered was certain customers got the vision of what we were talking about. That is, they actually understood it as well or even better than we did. And they were willing to buy the dream. We said, listen, if you want to be part of building this thing together, give us $20. Otherwise, get lost. And they got that. And they were willing to pay for that. Some bits included, too. And then we would work with them. So, like, I'll give you an example. We would often post features that were a little bit premature in our forums. Like, well, we always run under your own name. And quite often, you'd have these posts that would be like, you idiot. How could you have shipped feature X without also shipping feature Y? Don't you know that feature Y is absolutely essential? And our first impulse, of course, is to argue and be like, well, feature Y is on the roadmap, okay? It's going to come out next. You know, shut up, right, stupid customer. But eventually, we learned that actually the right response is, you're a genius. Thank you so much for suggesting feature Y. We're going to get right on that. Since feature Y is already on the roadmap, it comes out a week later. And they feel like, boy, those guys really listen to me. Right? And like you start doing that enough times, you get these customers who are kind of like, you know what? I kind of built this product. I mean, sure, these guys are the hired help. But they didn't do that much. Without me, they wouldn't even ship feature Y. So, you know, A, they have a sense of ownership of the product that's really intense. And then you watch some other punk come onto the forums like 6 months later. They're to be like, InView sucks, it doesn't have feature, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, listen, you don't understand. They didn't even know about feature Y until I told them. Okay, so these guys know what they're talking about. You know, you get the hell out of here. You don't have to argue with the forums. It's a waste of time to let them argue with each other to save your life. Answer your questions. Are there other questions? Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about monetizing. So, I mean, I know that, for instance, very recently, InView and then shortly thereafter, Second Life, started offering music in
in their virtual worlds. I was wondering if you could talk about the process that you went through in trying to figure out what people will actually pay for. Is that any different than what you described?
Steve and I are thinking the same thing. I shouldn't comment on a development initiative that's in progress in the company.
Okay.
So I shouldn't talk about that specifically, but what I will say in general is what I'm talking about here is the core idea of trying to get the whole company thinking about how is this going to be a successful business. Anyone who's not on board for that mission can walk out the door. And anyone who says, you know what, understanding the business strategy, that's not my department, that's somebody else's department, we would fire. Right? The idea was every person needs to know what our business financials are. They need to understand what our monthly revenue is and the targets. They need to understand everything. We were very transparent about that. We would walk everybody through the whole P&L every month. Every month, including the bad months, where the revenue is down and we're running out of cash and things are not looking good. Our feeling was if the company's in crisis, people need to know it's in crisis so they can do something about it. And oftentimes we'd have in those meetings and be like, wait, you're telling me the company's in crisis, but we have initiative XYZ going on, wasting tons of money? We'd be like, we do. Thanks. Thanks for mentioning that, because that initiative is canceled right now. You know, or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Dying to talk about. Really thinking about it. The closest analogy I can think of is... Yeah, you know what? I'm not going to say anything about it.
See me
after class. We're talking about. I got to be careful what I say.
Other questions?
I saw this question up in the back.
Oh, the people love it too.
Yeah, there weren't. We never got any engineers who got it. That was impossible because we were trying to pioneer something new and something that's very counterintuitive for engineers schooled in the idea of best practices. And so our goal was not to find people who already got it, but find people who had an open mind who could become indoctrinated into our way of thinking. Like what we would do, we would look for engineers who had a failed project in their didn't matter if it was a big open source project or a big corporate project, but somebody who's written software that today is sitting on a shelf or nobody used. That is, they kind of get viscerally how painful it is to ship software that's a waste of time. We would get people who felt that pain, and then we would tell them, listen, there's a better way, and we want you to trust us that we know the better way and try it. And we will invest the energy in you to help you unlearn all your bad habits from before. We will teach you this new thing from the ground up. And by the way, you're going to ship software to customers on your first day. And quite a few people would panic and bail at that point. They're like, oh, that can't possibly work. But we insisted every engineer is going to ship something to customers day one. Our process was that automated, and we were that confident in our what we called the cluster immune system of automated testing and automatic verification of changes, that if you were to walk back to my desk at InView, in those days, and you were to sit at my desk and check in some stupid infinite loop on some high-traffic page that was going to like destroy the site, the system would actually send you an email to be like, dear Eric, thank you so much for attempting to check in this thing, but it's a bad idea, and it's been rejected. So that was completely automated. So we got people in a situation that they felt very uncomfortable very quickly, and then we would help them learn that that was okay. So like, especially for people who've worked for years at Yahoo or something like that, the idea that they're going to put something in customers' hands on day one was both very scary, but also very powerful. That said, listen, when you master this technique, if you have a good idea, you will never have to ask a manager for permission. Like the right kind of engineers respond to that idea.
Another question.
My question is after that. So you were VP of engineering, then VP of marketing. Yesterday I checked the website. You were not on the management team.
Yeah.
And you were a month ago. What's the rest of the story?
first of all, where are you now?
I'm at Kleiner Perkin.
And Eric, just for the class, when did you start writing code?
Oh, me personally?
Yeah.
Yeah, when I was a kid.
How?
I was, 8 years old or something. I'm one of those people that was writing code as long as I can remember.
And where was your first company?
I did a startup while I was in college, writing Bubble. Nice. Because, that was the thing that people were doing. It was all a disaster, in case you're wondering. But the euphemism of choice is good learning experience. So, that's my background.
And Eric, when we went from $300 a month to $8,000, you mentioned $80,000, where do we go next?
But the company has said publicly, I think, is that we made $10 million in 2007, and we made more than that in 2008, but I don't think that number's been disclosed yet.
And so. I think publicly they just announced what? About fundraising?
Oh, they just raised another $10 million?
Yeah.
and Best Buy Capital.
They have $1 million a month of revenue now.
Is that what they're saying? And that's what they're saying. Probably plays down expectations extremely well. But to answer your question directly, I mean, this is, I can't tell you 5 years of the story, but the company's done very well. It's about a 50-employee company now. We did eventually bring in a professional CEO. And, you know, after a certain number of years, I felt like it was time for me to move on.
Professional CEO as in professional CEO there, or?
Well, so I think we did substantially better than we did it there. And also, we brought in Jamie Bell gets a bad rap in there. I mean, listen, don't get me wrong. I think he really was incompetent. He made some tragic, tragic mistakes that destroyed that company. But he was structurally set up to fail, which is a classic mistake VCs make. And I say this now having seen it from the other side. You want to bring in an execution team to, like, take this thing to the moon. And if you do that too soon, it's just absolutely lethal. So, you know, we brought in a professional CEO when we were 40 to 45 employees. We already had $10 million in revenue. We had a series of execution problems that really lent themselves to, you know, someone with real professional general management training. That's just not what an early stage startup needs. And in fact, you can't have it both ways. You're kind of either investing in learning or you're investing in execution. It's very hard to do.
Okay. Eric?